Good afternoon, and welcome to week 23. Today is May 16th, so that means we have class next week. We do not have class on the following week. May 30th, we do not have class, because that will be Erev Shavuot, you should be taking a nap. For anyone who's in Thornhill, you are more than welcome to come to the shiurim. I'll do that night, and you can make up this one fivefold. But yeah, we are in Ezra Perek Chet, chapter 8, page 1831. The story sheets are on the back table. You will note a special feature this week, entirely unintended. Which is that the printer, for some reason, flipped them short side instead of long side. So when you finish the first side, just go like this, and you'll be fine. Special feature. We can charge more for it. Okay. So we started Parakas last time. We started chapter 8 last time with the name list, the list of the people who came with Ezra. We talked about why Ezra wants to make such a list. We noted that this will fit Ezra's pattern of de-emphasizing himself and instead talking to those around him. We noted that he does talk about his own lineage, had some conversation about that. Noted some nuances within the list itself, and then moved into the populating of the Beit HaMikdash, and specifically the problem of missing Levites. They wait 3 days, and there are no Levian, and so Ezra ends up asking them to the Nesinim, can you bring us some Levium? They bring some Levium. Fine. We talked about why you didn't have more Levium show up, and the idea that we had multiple explanations. One approach was that the Levium who they had cut off their thumbs, this medrash that they didn't accept being forced to play their songs for their Babylonian captors, and the way they did it was saying, ha, now we can't play anymore. Eich nashir et shir Hashem. How can we sing? Not, we won't sing, but how can we? We're not able to. And we noted, actually, I think Rebecca asked the question last time, that was the original generation. This is now 70 years later. And I actually came across, quite by accident, as part of learning something else, I came across someone who did, in fact, ask this question, the Maharam Lublin, writing on the Talmud in Yevamot, asked this question, and Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, in a response, addressed it and said, yeah, I'm not troubled by this. And he talks about the issue of the time frame, the timing that was involved, and who we know survived from the first temple to the second temple. It's its own question. In any case, that was one approach. A second approach was to suggest, as people here, I think, floated the idea, maybe they had been killed by the Babylonians in defending the Beis HaMikdash. There actually is just a smaller number of them, because they were the defenders of the temple. And we had another approach that maybe they didn't retain their identity, because there was nothing special for them to do. And that's something that we see today with Levium, that there are far fewer Levium around, even though they should be a much larger population than the Kohanim. And then the last explanation from the Dan Mikra, he floated the idea that we saw verses in Yechezkel in which he criticizes the Levium who had sinned and warns about them trying to come serve in the temple. And maybe they said, you know what, maybe for us we should hold off. And we shouldn't show up. And the last bit that we did was the punishment of the Levium. The Gemara in Yevamo says that the Levium actually have Maaser Rishon taken away from them. The tithe that's normally supposed to be given to the Levium is taken away and either given to the Kohanim or given to the needy. And the big question we had was, well, where is this penalty found in the text? Our text doesn't say anything about any sort of punishment for them. And we offered two explanations, which Tosfot, commenting on the Talmud, offers. Neither of them is remarkably compelling. I'm not going to go through them again. But really, that's the best we can do. Because ultimately, what the Talmud is doing is observing, we don't give Maaser to the Levi. And it's saying, the reason why we don't is because, but they had a practice. By the time you hit Talmudic times, they know we don't give Maaser to the Levi. And so everything afterwards is just, you know, let's see if we can figure out where this fits into Tanakh. That brings us to what we're up to now, which is the rest of chapter 8. Ezra is going to turn to God and say, help us on our journey. Then they're going to break up the gifts that have to be brought among the travelers, and then they'll go on their way, and they'll come to Jerusalem, and they'll do what they do, as we'll see when they get there. If we get into chapter 9, then we're going to have a problem. Not a problem because I'm out of notes, I'm not. But we'll get into the major problem that will occupy the rest of the book of Ezra and much of the book of Nehemiah, which is the discovery that many of these Jews, fine people who have decided to want to come back to Israel, have a little bit of an issue, which is that they have apparently married in Babylon, and we're not talking about marrying other Jews in Babylon. There's actually going to be some debate as to when the intermarriage took place. That'll be part of the conversation, but that's going to occupy the rest of the book of Ezra, chapters 9 and 10, as well as a good chunk of the book of Nehemiah. Let's go backward, though. Let's go back to where we begin, which is Ezra about to leave. Chapter 8, sentence 21. You are at the bottom of page 1831. Ezra says, I called a fast by the river Ahava. We already discussed last time where that is in relation to the Euphrates. Liz Anos Lifnei Elokeinu. The goal was for us to fast before our God. Levakesh mimenu derech yeshara, to seek from him a derech yeshara. Literally, derech yeshara is a straight path. What does it mean here? No, I wouldn't use it. It's not an ethical term in this context. Sorry? Safe journey! Safe journey, favorable passage. That, you know, part of it really may be a straight path. In other words, you're making the journey from the Euphrates to Jerusalem. You know, how do you know which way to go? You know, it's not as though any of them have ever been out of Babylon. So the part of it really is, if you could send us a GPS, that would be wonderful. So there's a fast call for a straight path. Maybe we should have done that in the Midbar. The lanu ulatapenu ulachol rechushenu, for us, for our children, and for all of our property. It's nice that we have our priorities in order. Kivoshti lishol min hamelach. Here's the interesting thing. He says, I was shy about, reticent about, asking the king, chayilu parashim l'ozreinu me'oyev baderach. I was reluctant to ask him for soldiers, charioteers, to help us against enemies on the way. So yeah, he's not really concerned about getting lost. He's concerned about getting attacked. And he says, I could have asked for help. He's been licensed to do basically whatever he wants, right? We spent a lot of time on all the different powers that have been given to him. But he says, yeah, I didn't want to ask the king for help. Why don't you want to ask the king for help? Anyone who hasn't yet read the next verses... Okay, anyone who hasn't yet read them, why do you think he doesn't want to ask for help?
It looks like he doesn't have emunah.
Looks like he doesn't have faith. That was the answer. Ki amarnu lamelech, because we had told the king, Lamor, saying, Yad Elokeinu al-kol mevakshav l'tova, that God helps all those who seek him for the best. Ve'uzo ve'apo al-kol ozevav, and people get punished if they stray from God. So we had given the king the sense that we believe in a God who watches what goes on in this world and takes care of the good guys. How could we then display lack of faith by saying to the king, however, we have this principle in Judaism, ein somchin al hanes, you don't rely on miracles. It doesn't really go well, expecting to convey that message in a way that will be convincing to the king. And remember, Ezra's whole license to go is because the king views him as this highly religious person. So he doesn't want to shake that faith. So instead, we'll just pray to God for safety along the trip. Vanatsuma, we fasted. Und vanevakshame elokeinu alzos, we asked God for this. And lo and behold, vaye aser lanu, God answered us. It was good. So a couple of notes here. First of all, we do have a principle of ein somchin al hanes. We do have a principle that you're not supposed to rely on miracles. And even though we are promised that a person on the way to do a mitzvah is not going to be harmed, we are also told, don't push it. You're not supposed to put yourself in a dangerous position. You know, saying, well, I'm doing a mitzvah, so therefore it's on God to help me. It doesn't work that way. Nonetheless, the commentators say he didn't want to go through this with the king. Take a look at Rashi in source number one. Sharekvar Amarnu al Daryavash HaMelech, we had already told King Darius, / Artaxasta, Shagadish Baruch Hu Meitivu Mevakshav V'Shofech HaPovach HaMaso Alozvav, that God helps those who seek him, and that God pours out his wrath upon those who leave him. I think the point of mentioning the pouring out of the wrath, the reason to mention the negative, is to say that this wasn't part of a conversation with the king about their trip. It was a global conversation in which they're explaining the way Jews look at the world. And they're saying, this is what we've been taught, that God helps the good guys and punishes the bad guys.
It's both encouragement and warning to him also.
Yeah, theoretically it could also be a message to the king. You know, the question, of course, is always, but, you know, didn't he know this world? Hasn't he seen this world, right? Didn't he read Eo? Doesn't he know that it doesn't always work that way? But nonetheless, yes,
Sue. If Darius believed that God had this power, then how did the Jews get in exile for so long? Like, the fact that the Jews were punished so badly, didn't that make it think maybe God doesn't watch over them so well?
Or it would be the way we said it earlier in the book, right? Remember their message originally, when Tatnai came to the Jews and said, "Hey, what are you doing? Why do you think that it's okay for you to build?" Their response to him was to recount their history, and when they recounted their history, they said, "We had sinned and we had strayed, and therefore God punished us. But now we have atoned for our sins, and it's time for us to come back." So. You know, being forthright and saying that what happened to us initially was a punishment is probably the best antidote for that kind of an allegation. So he says, God answered me. How does he know God answered him? So the easy answer that I would have given is it's a flashback. Right. In other words, it's not as though Ezra's writing this down as a diary while it's happening and he has no ability to edit it later on. Although some parts of it maybe could have used that. That would be the easy answer. And it's very funny because nobody among the traditional commentators gives that answer that it's written later. I think the reason why they don't like that answer is because when it describes the trip, he's going to separately say, God answered us. And so it's redundant. If that's what you meant, then you could have just relied on the fact that you're going to say it. And we traveled, and we were safe. God had listened to us. Maybe it's because of this extra mention. But even Ezra, who we think of as a very hard-headed rationalist, says that he knew either because he had prophecy, or a prophet, either he had prophecy personally, or a prophet came to him and informed him, God is going to help you.
Where does it say God answered him?
And the end of the sentence. Vayaser lanu. How do they translate the last two words in sentence 23? Yes.
He was entreated of us.
He was entreated of us.
That's an answer.
That's a very... Right, well, that's because it's a mistranslation. the reason why I say it is because the word ayin tav resh that's used here for prayer is an unusual term. It is, though, used back in Sefer Bereishit. What's the story? Rivka and Yitzchak. Good. When Rivka and Yitzchak prayed to have children, it says Vayetar as the prayer, and Vayaser Lo Hashem Vatar Rivka Ishto. So that would translate it as, and God was entreated of him, and Rivka conceived. But the usual way to take it is to look back at this word, ayin tav resh. Ayin tav resh is a term that when it doesn't mean prayer, in other words, in its normal use, it's not a prayer use, it refers to a pitchfork. Huh? And to the act of turning the grain. Atira, ayin tav yud resh hay, is the act of turning the grain, you know, the hay that's been harvested, with a pitchfork. And so the assumption traditionally is that it's a borrowed word when it comes to prayer, and it's to say, it wasn't just that he put his prayer in front of God in a very calm, orderly type of a presentation, but rather, it was done with real emotion. It was like with a twisting and a turning, and that's the appeal to God, and that the response of God is to allow himself to be moved by that entreaty, or whatever term you want, by that pitchforking, essentially. And that's Vayaser, God, he pitchforked God, and God was pitchforked. if you will. So it's not simply, you know, a confirmation message, we have received your voicemail, but rather it's he was influenced by it, he was affected by it. And that's why the translations all assume that it means that God, he's saying, yeah, God took. God said, this is a prayer I'm going to answer. Malam offers a different explanation for how he knew, which I find fascinating, and I mention it because I find it fascinating. Source number two, he points you to a Mishnah in Brachot. It's a classic. Amru Alav al Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, you have to remember who Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa is. In the Talmud, among the sages of the Mishnah, Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa is one of maybe three who are traditionally known as miracle workers. They do things that other people can't get away with. So Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa is, like, if I remember correctly, the Gemara in Tanis, I think it's him, is the one who, when he's going to go out on the road and it's raining, says to God, you know, God, your servant Chanina is in, everybody else is happy, but your servant Chanina is in pain. And the rain stops. And then he arrives at his destination, and he says to God, that's not right. Your servant Chanina should be happy, but everybody else should be in pain, and the rain starts again. That's that kind of trick. God is described as praising Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa and saying, yeah, he provides food for the rest of the world and he survives on a measure of carobs all week long. He doesn't take for himself. He may not want to be wet, but he's not selfish. So in any case, look at this story. They say Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, Shaya mispalel al hacholim. He used to pray for the sick. Ba'omer, and he would say, Zechai v'zemes. That's scary. They make a mishaberach, and afterwards the gabbai turns to you and says, sorry. That's not funny. So Amru lo, they said to Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa, Minayin atah yodea, how in the world do you know? So Amar lahem, to which he replied, Im shgurat filasi b'fi, yodea ani shehu mekubal. If my davening is, if it flows well in my mouth, then I know it's been accepted. Vim lav, but if it doesn't flow well, yodea ani shehu metarap, I know it has been torn up. He actually had a sense, based on the way the words came out, of whether it was being received well or not. What in the world that means, I cannot begin to tell you. But he had an awareness somehow, and the Malvim says, maybe that's what Ezra had. So Ezra knows, God's going to hear me. God is going to listen. Okay. So, however you slice it, Ezra does not want to look bad by saying to the king, can you send us some armed guards? But instead, he turns to God for help, and he says, God listened. Then we get down to some practical details. Sentences 24 to 30, still in chapter 8. If you're using the stone, you're at the bottom of page 1831. Va'avdila misareya kohanim shneimasar. I identified 10 leaders of the 12 leaders of the Kohanim. L'sherevya chashavya ve'imahem me'achehem asara. Two, Sherevya and chashavya, and another 10 of them. Who are Sherevya and chashavya? We've seen them before. In this chapter. Yes, sentences 18 and 19. Comes back from Israel, has the answers. If you were there, it's Israel. The sentences 18 and 19, those were the Levim who were brought. In other words, what Ezra does is he identifies 12 Kohanim and in parallel, 12 Levim. Sherevya, Chashavya, plus another 10. Dat Mikra suggests that Ezra is sensitive to the need to buck up the Levium a little bit, to give them a sense of pride. And so he says, I'm going to match them. Kohanim with Levium, going to be 12 and 12. We're going to see him do the same thing later on in the chapter. He's going to do the same thing with the Kohanim and Levium, make sure to give them equal time. So 12 Kohanim, 12 Levium, yeah.
Is
Is it the lama that makes you think? Because when I initially read it, I thought, I know, I separated like of the 12 Kohanim, and then I thought that was telling us who they were.
Well, the problem with telling us who they were is that they're Levites.
I understand.
So you can't really say that. But in any case, what told it to me was the Dot Mikra when he made the comment. He says on this, Lamed HaHosafa is a Lamed of adding, as in I separated them in addition to, etc. Okay. So he separates 12 Kohanim, he separates 12 Levim, and he says in sentence 25, Va'ashkala lahem es hakesef es hazahav es hakelim. I parceled out to them silver, gold, and utensils, trumas beis elokeinu, the gift that's been brought for the house of our God, haherimu, that is a terrible word, but apparently grammatically it made sense for them. Haherimu means that which they had elevated, that which they had tithed, hamelech v'yawatzav v'sarav, the king, his advisors, his officers, v'chol Yisrael anim, and all of the Jews who were around. So these are the gifts that are being sent, and he says Vashkalal Yadam Kesef Kikarim Sheshme Os Vachamishim. I assigned them silver quantity is 650 kikar of silver, Uchlei Kesef Me'al Kikarim, and then silver vessels weighing 100 kikar, Zahav Me'a Kikar, and 100 kikar of gold. Uchfore zahav esrim, as well as 20 gold kiforim. How do they translate kiforim here? Usually it's a, sorry?
Bulls.
Okay, no, that's reasonable. Usually what it is, a kaporet in the Torah, is a bowl that's used to hold the blood after the karban, the offering. So that bowl is a good word. Sorry? What do you? Vessels? Well, that's a cop-out. Okay. Vessels is what you say when you're stuck. It's a vessel. It's a tool. I'm sorry? Oh, kaparos. Kaparos is, no, because that's an act of atonement. It is different, although if you get down to the etymology, there are those who claim an association. Having to do with wiping off the blood and wiping off the guilt. In other words, they suggest that the word kaf hei resh is to wipe off, and that lechaper, to atone, is you're wiping away the sin, and on the kaporet, they wipe their finger, because they have to dip their finger into the blood. So it's not far for you to say that there is a link between the two. La'adarchonim aleph. So in addition to the gold coins, we also have adarchonim or darkonim, which are coins. Or passports in modern Hebrew, that's right. So 1,000 of those. Uchle nechoshes mutzhav tova shnayim chamudos kazahav. As well as, in addition to that, we have vessels, like kalim, I'm going to use, well, kalim is generic, so I'm okay. Vessels made of copper that shines like gold. Two of them, and they were chamudot. So chamudot literally is what we usually use to refer to something that is beloved or precious or valuable. Daniel ish chamudot is one use of the term.
Is that what you say when you
say chamud? Chamud, something. Yeah, but it's more like cute, but nonetheless, it's not a cute brass vessel. It's not what we're talking about. They say as splendid as gold. Okay, splendid. Splendid is a nice word.
Precious
there. I prefer precious. Okay. Va'omra lahem. So here's what I said to them, to these Kohanim and Levim. Atem kodesh l'Hashem. You are sacred to God. Va'kelim kodesh. And these vessels I've given you are also sacred. Va'kesev va'zahav nedavah l'Hashem elokei avoseichem. And the silver and gold, it's a gift for God, the God of your ancestors. Shikdu v'shimru. Be very diligent and careful. Shin kuf dalet is a term that we use not only for almonds, but also for shkida, for someone to be diligent. So be very careful. Ad tishkelu lifnei sarei kohanim v'aleviim, until you're going to weigh this out for the kohanim and leviim, their officers. V'sarei ha'avos liYisrael b'Yerushalayim, and the heads of the families in Jerusalem. Halishchos beis Hashem at the offices of the house of God. In other words, you're accountable. I'm giving you all this stuff. You're going to take it along the way. And at the end, there will be an accounting to make sure that you handled it properly. V'kiblu ha-kohanim, finishing the section, pasuk lamed, v'kiblu ha-kohanim v'alabim mishkal ha-kesef v'azav ha-kilim, so they accepted this weight of silver, gold, and vessels, la'avi l'Yerushalayim l'beis Elokeinu, to bring to Yerushalayim, to the house of our God. Malbim notes the double measuring that goes on. It's going to be measured twice, to ensure accuracy and to avoid suspicion. But he notes that you actually see it in Yirmiyahu as well. I gave you the reference on your sheet in source number 3. We don't need to look it up right now. But when Yirmiyahu buys the field in Anatot, right? Yirmiyahu was told, Jeremiah is told that he has to give a message to the Jews that they're going to be coming back to the land. And the message is, go buy land and store the document, because that's a sign that the Jews are coming home. And they weigh out the currency twice. So this was a practice simply to ensure that everything is done on the up and up. And he says to them, you are holy, and these are holy. So the simple read is, what he means to say is what?
Set aside for this.
Right, but the simple read is, so it makes sense that you should be in charge. Your holy people, Kohanim and Levim, everybody's holy. Right? Korach said, Kulam Kedoshim. He wasn't wrong that we're all holy. Nonetheless, some of us are more holy than others. The Kohanim and Levim are Kodesh. Now, Kadosh doesn't have to mean specifically holy, because the term Kadosh in its original sense simply means set aside, designated, right? The use of it to mean Kadesha is testimony to that. It's not a term that's necessarily even a positive always. But but there is a sense of, you are set aside for the temple, these are set aside for the temple, so yeah, it's going to be your job and your responsibility to bring this. Malbim goes further with it in source number 4, and he says you're actually obligated to do so. This is your province, so don't try to get away from it. Interestingly, the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud in source number 5, says we learn something from here, and this is a halacha. Ma kelim hamishtamish b'hen ma'al, af hamishtamish b'kohanim ma'al. Just as if you use vessels of the temple for your own purposes, that's trespass, that's abuse of the property of the temple, so too you're not allowed to say to a Kohen, would you hold the door for me? Would you whatever? You're not allowed to ask that of a Kohen. He serves God, not you. I see people, families of Kohenim around the table. This is going to change the way they look at things. There is discussion about this and how serious this is. And does it apply to any sort of favor? What if they offer you a favor and so on? It's beyond the scope of what we're going to see right now. But at least since it's linked to our verse, I figured let me note it. So they assign this is a technical job. They have to assign the gifts. Who's going to take it? These people are going to take it. There's an accounting in the beginning. There's an accounting at the end. And now we get to the journey itself. That's going to be important. Pasuk Lamed Aleph, sentence 31.
Does this remain Ezra's responsibility for these
funds? Yes. Absolutely. Ezra is an expert delegator. You could look at it as we did regarding the name list and say this is because he loves the people and values the people and feels they should be in charge. Or you could look at it and say, why should I be the one who has to worry at the end about making sure there's nothing missing from all the silver and gold? You know, let me give it to somebody else. I prefer the former read. But
history says that our leaders are always troubled by this account.
Yes.
Samuel and Moshe.
And we're going to come back to that, to exactly that. You are correct. Rebecca, then Francis.
I'm just saying it empowers the people so that they take responsibility and start up for themselves.
Right. I would say so. I mean, there's also a lot of heavy silver and gold. Like, this isn't a small amount. Yes?
You mentioned at the beginning when you were describing the Ezra's that he was also an accountant.
Well, depending on how we take the word so fair, yeah.
So he'd be interested in details of this as well.
This is true. But it's good for the accountant if the accountant is simply keeping a record of what someone else is supposed to do. But I think part of it really may just be the weight of the silver and gold. Like, this is heavy stuff. What's he going to do? Carry 100 kikar? I mean, these are serious amounts. The Dan Mikra actually tries to give you a translation into weight on one of the numbers. Let me see if I can find it quickly.
it's also a recollection of carrying the bag.
Yeah, sorry. 100 kikar, he says it's 3,400 kilo. Good luck, Ezra. See you on the other end of the trip.
Isn't that what oxen are for? You get an ox and a current.
Right. Yeah, you get an animal. That's true. But how many animals will you need when that's only one piece of this burden? You know, it's an awful lot. You need to. I mean, I don't think the 12 Kohanim and 12 Levim are carrying it either. I think they're leading the animals that are carrying it. Okay.
It's also a recollection to carrying the vessels of the temple. Same group of people are doing it.
That's very interesting. I hadn't thought about it that way, but you're right. It makes sense to make that association. We've talked a lot about other associations from the past. So, you know, when they're traveling in the Midbar, in the wilderness, so the families of Levi carry the different elements of the Mishkan. The only difference is that it's only the Levium. In the Midbar, not the Kohanim, although there's actually discussion about whether the Kohanim perhaps were eligible, and maybe the Kohanim, there is discussion about this, the eligibility of the Kohanim to do the transport as well. So maybe that's also what it's meant to do. It's a throwback to what they did in the wilderness, part of that whole legitimacy. We are legitimate because we are emulating what our ancestors did. I hear that. That's a nice idea. Sorry?
They didn't have as much.
Oh, they did. The Mishkan's a heavy building.
Yeah.
I mean, broken into parts, but yeah, no, they had plenty to carry. Yeah.
So, like people knew
they had more Levium though.
In Babylon, when they left Babylon, they knew that all these Jews were carrying this gold and silver, and it's kind of remarkable that not one person attacked them.
Yeah.
Not one person like was right like the cloud that protected.
Yeah.
I'm going to be far because it's very strange that nobody wants.
Well, I could read it as miraculous. I could also say that anybody who knew they were carrying stuff knew that Artaxerxes, king of the Persian Empire, had sent them. There's a price to be paid for that gold. So you could look at it both ways. Let's see the actual journey. Pasuk Lamed Aleph, sentence 31. It's going to take us sentence 31 all the way to sentence 36. Vanisam min Nahar Ahava. So we left Nahar Ahava b'shneimasar lachodesh harishon, 12th day of Nisan. Right? We know that because we already discussed that when we began discussing the trip. Laleches Yerushalayim, to go to Jerusalem. V'yad Elokeinu haisa aleinu, God's hand was upon us. V'yatzilenu mikaf oyev v'orev al hadarech, He saved us from all the enemies on the road. And that's where it says it again that God had listened. By the way, you notice the phrase used to describe the enemy? Tfilas Haderech, right. You always wonder when you say Tfilas Haderech, right? The wayfarer's prayer. So it says in the Hebrew, we ask God to save you, Mikaf Kol Oyev V'Orev, etc. on the road. And you wonder, like, why do you need to say both? Oyev is an enemy, Orev is somebody who's lying in ambush. But they're also enemies. And the answer is because, as a general rule, and there's much to be said about that, all of our prayers are built on verses. They're all built on psukim. Every bracha on Shmona Esrei, every tefillah that you can think of, they're always based on the language of Tanakh. And there's a lot of reason for that. That's not random. So yes, this is intentional that we end up saying Mikaf Kol Oyev V'Orev in Tefillas Haderech. Fine. Vanavo Yerushalayim, we came to Jerusalem. He's not going to tell us anything about along the way. This is like, yeah, I would like to know. All right, fine. We came to Jerusalem. Vaneshev Sham Yamim Shlosha, and we sat there for 3 days. Uvayom Arvii, and then on the fourth day, Nishkal HaKesev Azav HaKilim BeBeis Elokeinu. All of this, silver, gold, all the utensils were all taken, and we understand to mean not just taken, but weighed, in the house of our God, Al Yedei Meremot Ben Uriah HaKohen, by Meremot, son of Uriah the Kohen, V'ima, Elazar ben Pinchas, along with him you had Elazar ben Pinchas, V'imahem, and with them, Yozavad ben Yeshua, V'Noadya ben Binui HaLevi'im, two more Levi'im were with them. They get their names into Tanakh as well. V'mispar b'mishkal lakol, by number, by weight for everything, meaning we are indeed calculating the whole thing. Vayikasev kol ha-mishkal bo'eis ha-hi. And the number, the weight, was actually recorded. So they're being very serious about weighing it on both ends and making sure nobody took anything. I'm going to come back to that in a moment. I just want to finish the sentences about this trip. Actually, no, let me pause there, because the next bit is going to be its own thing. So what questions come up in sentences 32 to 34? Yes? Sorry?
Same question, Selena. Why did they wait 3 days?
Yeah, what's with the 3-day wait?
Yeah, Abraham travels 3 days. We, everyone travels 3 days.
We like 3-day waits.
We like 3 days.
Remember that we had a 3-day wait before they started the trip also.
Right.
Last week we talked about the 3-day wait before starting the trip, and our answer there was because Ezra was about to pray to God for protection, and you're supposed to wait 3 days when you come off the road. He's been traveling, gathering everybody. You have to wait 3 days in order to offer a proper prayer. That was one explanation. Another explanation was they waited 3 days because they're hoping some other people are going to show up, perhaps a Levi or two. So maybe that's why you wait 3 days. But at this end, why are they waiting 3 days? It really could just be to gather themselves. Again, you've taken a trip of a few months. You don't really want to go meet everybody now. Like, let's just, stay away. We'll do everything. Just give us some time. And that could just be. Sorry?
To clean up.
Yeah, to clean up a little bit.
How long is the trip?
Well, we do know, right? We are told that they arrived in the month of Av, right? So they left in Nisan, they arrived in Av. You're talking about a 5-month journey. So, that's a very serious period. That's just short, actually 4.5 months, because they left on the 12th of Nisan, they arrived on the 1st of Av.
And you don't set up and get yourself,
Yeah, I mean, 3 days is a long time, but still.
3 days before entering
The language of the text is unclear, but it sounds like they're actually in Jerusalem. And they're saying, 3 days, then we'll answer everybody's questions, we'll give you all the gifts, we just need some time. They,
You know what? Maybe 3 days is a euphemism for a little while.
In a trip like this, where we've been recording... Right, but we've been recording dates all along, and they record dates here. I think 3 days is 3 days. They've been too meticulous about calendar issues to think that this is approximate. There's also something else here that's interesting about this business. The weighing twice we've talked about. But this fellow Murray Moat... We have to learn more about this fellow Murray Moat who's in charge of the weigh-in, because it's not simple. But first of all, in terms of the 3-day trip, take a look at your sheet, source number 6. I love this medrash.
Sorry, that's a question.
Yes.
Is it always written like backwards like that? I mean, Shorshas? Yeah. Is there a reason?
From time to time, we do it different ways. You know, you're in the middle of Sfiras HaOmer, right? So last night you said it was.
But I mean,
Chamisha Ushloshim, yeah.
Because
why not?
Right.
The argument I would give would be that it's actually based on syllables. In other words, Rabbi Yaakov Elman, who I studied under at YU, was of the belief that when you have a list, you'll have, let's say, 3 names in a list. You will often put the one that has the... You will do it in an increasing number of syllables. It's considered to just sound good. So going with more syllables, that's the one that's going to be stuck at the end of your list. And I wonder if Kiryamim Shalosha is as simple as that. It's euphonious. It sounds good. Yeah.
I was going to say we do that in English. Lock, stock, and barrel.
Right.
Bell, book, and candle. All of that.
Right. Right. It's just something that sounds good. And that really... It really could be as simple as that. But take a look at source number 6. Medrash and Bereshis Rabbah. Those who were here when I started Triassar here, which was 2009, they will remember this medrash.
Yeah.
Joycewood. The Vayom HaShalishi. This medrash says, on the 3rd day, Vayisa Avraham es Einav, right? At the Akedah. That's what this medrash is initially commenting on. At the Akedah, it's a 3-day trip to get to the mountain. And then Ksiv, the Medrash says, not only that one, but in Hosea, Yechayenu miyomayim, bayom hashalishi yekimenu v'nechye lefanav. This verse gets taken by the church, you will not be surprised to know. He will revitalize us from 2 days. On the third day, he will raise us up and we will live. Yeah. Again, like with many things with them, they had the verse before they had the story. Like, don't be shocked. Bayom HaShalishi Shel Shvatim. Ksiv Bayom Alehem Yosef Bayom HaShalishi, right? When the brothers come down again to Egypt, Yosef makes them wait 3 days, right, before they get their audience. Bayom HaShalishi Shel Maraglim, the spies in the not the spies in the Midbar, the wilderness, the bad spies, but the good spies, the ones who went to Jericho. To Jericho, have to hide for 3 days to avoid the troops from Jericho. 3 days at the giving of the Torah, right? On the third day of the 3 days of preparation, that's when they're given the Torah. After 3 days or on the third day, that's its own discussion. The third day for Yonah, right? Yonah spends 3 days in the fish before he calls out to God. The third day here of the Olei Golah, the Jews who come out of exile, as well as Tchiyas HaMesim, the idea of Tchiyas HaMesim, the ultimate revitalization of the dead, and that's that verse from Hosea. We use that pasuk that way. The third day of Esther, when she goes to Ahasuerus, right? All of these are 3 day things, and the Medrash even tries to link them in the last bit at the end of the Medrash that I won't go into right now. But the point is, we have lots of 3 day journeys, and frankly, this list is just the beginning. There are other 3 day journeys found in Tanakh, and to make a long story short, my understanding is that these are meant to be grouped together as periods of transition and growth. When you're coming from point A to point B, and going to point B is more than just a geographic thing, but actually you're supposed to be transformed. You're not who you were when you left. You take this 3 day period, whether it's Yonah, who's supposed to grow up inside the fish, or whether it's Avram and Yitzchak going together to the Akedah, right? Or the Jews getting the Torah at Sinai, and so on. With all of these, you're actually supposed to become somebody new, and you have this 3 day transition period. The Jews who come out of Babel are not simply a caravan of people who start out in Babylon and end up in Jerusalem. They were exiles. And an exile identity is fundamentally different from that of somebody who is in his own land. They already traveled for 4.5 months. However, having traveled for 4.5 months, now they need to spend 3 days in their own land in order to accept that new identity that they now have.
Debbie. Is it always new transformation?
I believe that's a common theme.
It means some kind of transformative experience. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I'm not saying that you don't take it literally. I'm not saying that it's not a 3 day trip or a 3 day wait. What I'm saying is that the goal of that 3 day period is for you to come out of the chrysalis at the end as something new. That's what I'm getting.
Well, when we see it, we know that it means that. That's sort of like a little.
Yes. It means look for what changed about them. Yeah. You couldn't do it in your 4.5 months. All the anticipation of having your own land is not the same thing as actually being there and feeling what that means. That's the idea. Okay. So they weigh everything out twice with this fellow Meremot apparently at the helm. So here's the reason why Meremot is interesting. Take a look at source number 7 on your sheet. I gave you a reference to a verse in Nehemiah. Chapter 3, sentence 4, if you're using the Stone Tanakh, it's just a hop, skip, and a jump, or maybe just a hop and a skip. Page 1841. A fairly mundane verse. Who do we encounter? Excuse me. Who do we encounter in this pasuk? Meremot, son of Uriah, son of Hakos. Now, it will be a tremendous leap for anybody to remember who Hakos is. So that's why I gave you in source number 7. I wouldn't have remembered who Hakos is. Go back to Ezra chapter 2, sentences 61 to 62. And you'll see why this matters. All right, page 1817 at the bottom.
What chapter?
Chapter 2. Sentences 61 and 62. Looking at it quickly, just read the English. Of the children of the Kohanim, this is the original name list of who came with Zerubbabel. Of the children of the Kohanim, the children of Chavaya, the children of Hakots, right? You see them? These are Kohanim. So far, so good. And it continues in sentence 62 to say, these saw their genealogical records and they couldn't be found, so they were disqualified from the priesthood. Oops. How does Meremot from Hakots end up in charge of weighing the gifts that you're bringing if he's disqualified from the priesthood?
What do you mean disqualified from the priesthood and not from
being an accountant, right?
He's dealing with things that are kadosh.
Right. It's surprising to see him in this role if he's disqualified. So the Da'at Mikra offers a suggestion and says the answer may be that when it mentioned the ones who had problems, they were descendants of Hakots. So Hakots is the big clan, and there's one branch that has a problem with their lineage. They can't prove that they married properly. And the other lineage is Meremot's family, and they're fine. That's Da'at Mikra's simple solution to the problem. However, the Encyclopedia Mikra It says this is really interesting. And the Encyclopedia Mikra It says this is evidence that the list in Ezra chapter 2 was original and not brought in later. Meaning there are always those among the critics who want to say that when you see name lists, they're actually parachuted in later on in history in order to honor people later on. But that makes no sense here. Because here you're taking Hakots, who had a position of power later on, and you'd be parachuting them in under the name of, yeah, these people were problems. They couldn't identify their marriages, and therefore we expel them from the Gehuna. That's not what you do with powerful people. Generally speaking, powerful people don't get expelled. So the Encyclopedia Mikra It says, if Hakots can be listed here, this list in chapter 2 must be authentic, and what must have happened was that later on they found their documents. And therefore, remember, these are decades in between.
Maybe this is what Ezra brought with him.
Maybe Ezra provided documents? I don't know. Could be. But the point is that later on, they over the course of the decades, they find papers and they're able to support their identity. That's the McRae's idea, which I found fascinating. Okay. So they do all their accounting. They write everything down. I noted for you on your sheet, if you flip the sheet both over and over. This is something that Rashi notes, but I brought you the Medrash Tanchuma, which is the earlier version of it, in Parshat Pikudei. Remember that when the Jews build the Mishkan, we get three separate accountings. The Mishkan, the temple the Jews traveled with in the wilderness on their way from Egypt into Israel, and then set up there in Israel. The first we get in Parshiot Truma and Tetzaveh, a description of everything that they are to build. Then, in Parshat Vayakel, we get a description of everything that they built. And that leads into Pikudei. And then, in Pikudei, we get an accounting of all the materials, and how much of this, and how much of that, and what it was used for. Everything is done, seriously, now you know why Jews become accountants. Everything is done step by step by step. Says the Medrash, why is it done step by step by step? In source number 8, Kishenasa Beis HaMikdash, when the temple was built, called Davar V'Davar Nasa B'Mispar U'V'Mishkal, everything was done by number and by weight, Shnemar, like our Pasuk said, right? By number, by weight, for all, B'Mispar V'Mishkal L'Kol, V'Yikatev Kol HaMishkal, I didn't translate the whole sentence for some reason, and the entire weight was recorded. Lama, why? Shehem rognim, because we complain. Shenamar by the Beraham Belokim of Moshe. They bring you one example. There were many. When the nation spoke against God and against Moshe, you know that people are going to start trouble. So therefore, you make sure that you cover your bases. That's the idea. Okay. So far, so good. So Ezra issued his prayer to God. He knows somehow that God has listened. Sure enough, they arrive safely. They present everything, and it's all weighed, measured, and so on by the Hakots family and others. And now, the last two sentences in the chapter. Pasuk Lamed Hey, Pasuk Lamed Vav. Those who came from the exiles, they brought burnt offerings to the God of Israel. Harim Shnemasar, 12 bulls, al kol Yisrael, for all Israel. And we already saw this phrase used when they dedicated the temple in the beginning. And they brought offerings al kol Yisrael. We said it's meant for all Jews, even those who were not actually present. Elim Tishim B'Shisha, 96 rams. Why 96? 8 per tribe. Okay. You're going to have problems now. Kvasim Shavim Meshiva, 77 sheep.
That's a lot of sheep.
Not only is that a lot of sheep, there were 96 rams, but now, why are there 77 sheep?
Lubavitch.
That's very good.
They didn't have 770. 70? Sorry?
It says here a magnification of the perfect number.
Oh, come on. We have so many perfect numbers. How can you choose? 6 is a perfect number. 7 is a perfect number. 4 is a perfect number. 3 is a perfect number. There's a reason we have a song that gives meaning for every single number. We could have gone all night. All right, who are they quoting with that?
Ryle.
Ryle. R-I-L-E. Don't know him or her. Okay. In any case, Tzvirei Chata Shnemasar. Tzvirim we've talked about. These are some kind of a goat, a young goat, a female goat. Different explanations are offered, but there are 12 of them as Chatat. We talked about this problem the last time round when they brought offerings for the dedication of the temple and they brought Chatat. Sounds like a sin offering, which I then have to ask, what did you do wrong? Right? Why are you bringing a sin offering? But then it gets even worse. Hakol Ola Lashem. All of it, a burnt offering for God. That's not the way it's supposed to work. What do you do with a sin offering? You eat some of it. No, sorry. The Kohen eats some of it, and some of it goes on the altar. An Olah, burnt offering, all goes on the altar. So what are they doing with this sin offering that they're burning the entire thing?
Are they doing it wrong?
Uh-oh.
Is it like Job, where he made the sin offerings for his sons, even though he didn't know for sure what the burn was? He didn't know for sure if they did or didn't, but just in case they did, we learned he made the sin offering.
Right. So it's an interesting idea. The problem is that we generally don't phrase that sort of practice. Meaning Job is unique. But generally speaking, one is not supposed to actually do that. The Talmud discusses that. There's a Mishnah that talks about a certain sage named Bava ben Buta, who used to bring an offering every single day, except for the day after Yom Kippur. They wouldn't let him do one the day after Yom Kippur because he just atoned. He just apologized and everything. You bring a different type of an offering. It's not called a chatat. There are other offerings to bring that if you just want to bring something just in case. Rebecca, you were going to say?
No.
Sorry. So this is a problem, what they're doing here, and we have to talk about it. But just to finish the chapter, they gave a record of all of the decrees of the king. This is a good idea. To the officers, not Jewish officers, to the officers of the empire on scene, the officers of this area west of the Jordan, and the nation and the house of God were elevated. Right? The officer said, oh, okay, law looks good to us. You are licensed by the king to go do everything you're going to do. So the question is, what is this business of the sin offerings? And I see that we have only 6 minutes left, and we're not going to finish everything, but we'll at least get started. Keep in mind that we had the same problem I mentioned before back in chapter 6, sentence 17, when they brought their offerings for the dedication of the temple. And our answer there was that a chatat is not necessarily a chatat. A sin offering is not necessarily a sin offering, meaning the word olah doesn't refer to what causes a burnt offering. It refers to the ritual that you perform with the burnt offering. It's all burnt. And the ritual of chatat, the things that you do, sharing it between the Kohanim and the altar and putting the blood on the altar in a particular way, this is what's called chatat. And we have precedent for it because the Talmud increases in Kritot says that there are people who bring a chatat who have done absolutely nothing wrong. People with certain types of impurity, a woman after giving birth, it's not a sin offering. She has done zero wrong, even though there are all sorts of creative interpretations for what may have been done wrong. I like the view of the Gemara, in which the Gemara says, plain and simple, it's actually a Mishnah, that it's not a sin offering. There's no sin that's been performed. The problem is that in that case, there was a justification for bringing offerings. If it's not a sin offering, what is it? It's miluim. We dedicate the temple, and we showed how every time we built a temple, we brought special offerings that are unique to that moment in time, and it doesn't have to fit any known paradigm. We're good with that. But Ezra and Kru are too late. They dedicated the temple 6 months ago. What are you doing here? This isn't miluim. So that doesn't justify what's going on here. Nonetheless, that's exactly the answer the Rambam gives, Rebecca.
Except that it's a unique time. You brought this huge, returning group of people.
Right.
It's a unique moment in history.
And maybe that's what drives the Rambam for saying what he says. If you take a look at source number 9, that's pretty much what he ends up saying. He says, just like when they dedicated the altar, meaning in the wilderness, the princes brought offerings which don't match anything else we would ever bring again, and they also brought them on Shabbos. So too the prince will bring his dedication in the future, as explained there, by which he means the verses in Ezekiel and Yechezkel that talk about the miluim. And so too the offerings they brought in the days of Ezra, who came from the spoils, miluim are you? They were miluim. And they're not brought in the future. It's not something you bring on an ongoing basis. That's his idea, that these are not brought on an ongoing basis. But he says, Ezra's group, that's not the group in chapter 6. So he simply believes, okay, you dedicated the altar and the temple, we're going to do another dedication of the altar and the temple. However, there is another answer, and that's the passage in the Talmud in source number 10. But rather than race through it, I think what we'll do is we'll pick up with that at the start next time. Thank you very much.